Hello, I'm Chris Gore. This is number 0658, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0658. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, multi-talented character actor and voice impressionist Jim Meskimen, who is also the son of actress Marion Ross. How well did it go over when Jim and his sister wanted to go into the family business?
We didn't have the traditional kind of rift, I think, that a lot of families do when one of the kids decides to go into show business. My mother was quite aware, I think, that we understood what we would be getting into and that we would be getting into it for the right reasons. My track was I sort of flirted with acting for a while I was also pursuing other work as an artist, a visual artist, and I didn't really make the commitment to it until I was in my 20s. And by that time, what my mother thought about it didn't really matter to me. But I think she prepared us well by showing us how to be a professional. And that's what the best thing I've gotten from her.
Hal Markowitz is the author of the novel Painting the White House. But in doing research for his fictional novel, he found some really odd facts about the real White House.
Donald Trump isn't the only president who has had an unusual relationship with the White House toilet. Lyndon Johnson used to have a very kind of public attitude when it came to using the toilet. If he was in an Oval Office meeting with a bunch of aides and heads of state and whomever, and he kind of felt the urge, there is a restroom right next to the Oval Office, Johnson would just get up from his desk, walk over, open the door, sit down, do his business, and continue conducting the meeting.
Stuart Nellman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nellman, and Book Banter looks back at the life and career of Mel Brooks, as seen by Mel Brooks, with All About Me. So get the campfire ready. The madness begins soon on the Stuff File Program. From Booker!
And of course, there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0658, was Chris Gore, a Palm Springs businessman and entrepreneur who has many businesses up and running, all of which have websites that you can find links to on my website, including his dog grooming and maintenance company called The Dog Man Cometh. Yes, you can go to the website and go to the show for this number, which you just heard Chris say. See how it all comes around full circle? And you'll find the link to all of his sites. And he's got quite a few of them. By the way, Chris Gore was also someone I went to high school with back in the day. Thank you very much, Chris, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Do you remember this jingle?
Have it your way, have it your way, have it your way at Burger King.
Well, here's a quote from Burger King's corporate offices in a news release after an incident at a franchise location in Miami, Florida. This unacceptable behavior does not align with our brand values. What behavior, you ask? Well, it all started when an employee got into a dispute with someone in the drive-thru, and it escalated when the customer threw or squirted mayonnaise in her face and then drove forward and parked.
Hold the pickle, hold the lettuce, special orders don't upset us. All we ask is that you let us serve it your way.
Well, the employee did get upset. She went out to her own car, where she grabbed a pistol and fired 5 shots at the fleeing customer as he drove off. The employee got into her car and left. Police found her car abandoned nearby with the gun on the floorboard and went to the address on the registration. There, they arrested 30-year-old Shatisha Monique Hicks. But since the customer has not come forward, The charge so far is simply discharging a firearm in public. Do you think that somewhere along the way the phrase, "hold the mayo," was uttered?
Have it your way, have it your way at Burger King, way at Burger King.
Was that percussion I heard in the background of that jingle? Or gunfire? Anyway, around Corsham, Wiltshire, England, people, sheep, even a former police German shepherd, are being terrorized by two aggressive canines. Said City Councillor Ruth Hopkinson, "There are two unpleasant chihuahuas who attacked the German shepherd, so the size of the dog is no reflection on their aggressiveness. They weren't leashed, and the owner thought, they're only little, they're only friendly, but you have to be really careful." One resident described the chihuahuas as bloody Mexican hooligans. Well, that sounds mildly inappropriate.
Yo quiero Taco Bell.
And Hopkinson warned that the little dogs are causing havoc during a sensitive time of year. She goes on to say, "If in a lambing field, please keep to the pass and your dog on a leash. When they're spooked, the ewe and lamb can become separated, and because they're not very bright creatures, they can't find each other, and it's leading to lamb deaths. The dogs might just be playing, but that's not how the sheep see it." Well, sometimes, you know, terrorists do come in small packages. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, when Steve Nichols and John Wynn of Indian Trail, North Carolina, saw a TV news story about a dog whose owners abandoned him because they thought he was gay, they knew that they had to do something. The couple of 33 years drove all the way to Albemarle on March 23rd to adopt the dog, whom they named Oscar, after the Irish poet Oscar Wilde. Oscar's previous owners had surrendered him for humping another male dog, which Nichols said was one of the stupidest things I'd ever heard. That's just pack behavior. Nichols noted that the dog hadn't been neutered and was suffering from heartworm, which led him to believe that the owner apparently didn't do anything to take care of this dog. Oscar is getting the care he needs and will join the couple's other dog, Harry, at their home. Yeah, I mean, seriously, dogs will hump a table leg, a human leg, just about anything. That doesn't make them gay.
How much is that dog in the window? The one with the wackily tail.
Are you sure that's a tail? Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Jim Meskimen is a very busy actor. You may not remember his name, but you'll most certainly know his face because he's everywhere. You might even know his voice because he has a lot of them. He's guested on dozens of shows from NCIS to Parks and Recreation to Brooklyn Nine-Nine to Friends to The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. I could go on and on and on. Jim joins us via Zoom from Atlanta. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, Peter. Actually, I'm back in Los Angeles. I was in Atlanta and I'm home now.
Oh, you're back in Los Angeles. Okay, great. As I said, you're very, very busy, so I'm glad you've taken the time to chat with us a little bit.
My pleasure. And probably a lot of your listeners will have heard my voice as Colonel Sanders.
Yes.
Although I'm not sure if the commercials run up there in Canada or not.
Oh, yes. Yes, we get to see them all the time.
Okay.
And we get to hear all your voices. Something I wanted to talk about as well. Also, I had the pleasure on this program just 4 years ago to talk to your mom, Marion Ross, when her book came out.
Yeah, we helped her to put that book together. It was a great, I'm so glad we did it because she's such a wonderful person and she's had such a wonderful life. It's just wonderful to have it to be shared with everybody like that.
The first question I wanted to ask is sort of a follow-up to a question I had asked your mom 4 years ago. Mm. And that is, you are an actor. I believe your sister is a writer, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
How well did it go over when the two of you wanted to go into the biz?
You know, we didn't have the traditional kind of rift, I think, that a lot of families do when one of the kids decides to go into show business. Because we, you know, my mother was quite aware I think that we understood what we would be getting into, and that we would be getting into it for the right reasons. My sister started as an actress and then migrated into writing and producing, and that's she's had a very stellar career and has even won an Emmy. My track was I sort of flirted with acting for a while I was also pursuing other work as an artist, a visual artist, and I didn't really make the commitment to it until I was in my 20s. And by that time, what my mother thought about it didn't really matter to me. But I think she prepared us well by showing us how to be a professional. And that's what the best thing I've gotten from her.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned earlier is you do voices. And I'm also, and by the way, I saw your run on America's Got Talent, which was a lot of fun.
Yes.
You do voices. So I'm just curious to know, what was the first voice you ever did when you were a kid? And also, what was the first voice you ever did professionally?
Oh, okay. Good questions. Yeah. As a kid, I probably imitated a family member, I imagine. I mean, that's what most of us do. I do remember imitating the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz when I was, you know, probably four, giving that a try. Because I, you know, you watch these movies when you're a kid and you just love the Tin Man and you love the Scarecrow so much. You want them to be your friend and you want to be like them. And so, if I were king of the forest, only probably sounded like, if I were king of the forest. And then professionally, I used to do a lot of stuff for a show called the McNeil Lair Report.
Right.
It had a cartoon segment, believe it or not. It was a news show, a hard news show, news magazine back in the day when there were three channels. And they would take the editorial cartoons of the day and we would voice them, me and my friends in my improv company. So I probably did, Boris Yeltsin or Ronald Reagan or someone of that ilk, Peter. Mm. You're too young to remember.
Oh, gosh, no, I'm not that young at all.
And then I've just continued to do a lot of presidents, like at George W. Bush. He was used to the president of the United States, which I believe is just across the pond from you all in Canada.
Yeah, something like that.
and Robert De Niro, of course, I've done many times, and Christopher Walken. These are all very popular voices. But I also do, some Brits like Colin Firth and Sir Ian McKellen as well, when it's needed. And it's astonishing how often these voices are needed to supplement movies and television, you see.
Well, have you done a lot of work where you have worked doing voices for actual actors?
Oh, yeah, I have. Often in the world of trailers, when you're watching a trailer, they didn't call back Colin Firth to do a shorter version of a line for the trailer for 1917, for example. Instead, they hire somebody like me. And there's a whole cadre of us here in Hollywood, a bunch of actors that are voice matches
for, people like Tommy Lee Jones, who just can't be bothered to come in and do a couple of lines for a trailer. I imagine he has much better things to do. And we sort of fill in.
When did you realize you were good at this, at doing impressions?
Well, I had a strong affinity for it, and I was a little embarrassed about it, or not embarrassed exactly, but sort of shy about it. I didn't want to be criticized, by my friends about it. But I, with close friends, I could whip out any voice and they'd be very appreciative. I guess I was a little nervous about how strangers would take it. But after a while, when I was in New York City and I got into the improv scene with my group Interplay at the time, then I got very loose and very willing, and willingness is a big part of talent. I think, you can have a lot of talent, but if you're not willing to demonstrate it or display it, then the world doesn't find out about it.
When you first started, having a mother who was already in entertainment, was it a situation where she was giving you the real deal? In other words, it's not a situation where a mom says, oh, my son, he can do anything. Was she the kind of person who said, oh, that's really good, dear, but you have to work on this or you have to work on that?
No, she was the kind of mom, which I'm eternally grateful for, who was charmed and supportive of everything I did. And I think it's a great way to be. You can punch holes in that approach. You can say, it's unrealistic or whatever. But there's nothing like having somebody who is unconditionally in your corner. And that's what Mom was to me.
One of the things I truly enjoy, it makes me laugh every time I see it, is you playing George Washington in a Geico commercial.
Yeah, that was a really fortuitous thing. That George Washington crossing the Delaware Expressway. It was actually shot on a street here in Los Angeles, but they mocked it up to look like the East Coast. And man, it was great. I was on that boat. It ran for a few months. We're on that boat as a bunch of men in Revolutionary War costumes were pushing it across the highway and trying to maintain my dignity and being George Washington and coming up with the voice for George Washington, which I always thought should sound sort of like this, you know? We've all got places to go. We've all got places to go. And there was a man in the car.
Right.
There's a whole backup. The traffic is backed up for miles behind this procession. And the other guy that I reacted to in the commercial was a friend of mine, an actor that I'd been in Apollo 13 with, Jeffrey Blake. And he'd been in a lot of movies for Ron Howard, and he's worked with Tom Hanks several times. He's in Forrest Gump. And his entire role was to look at me kind of like, are you really doing this? And raising his hand as if like, do you see that I'm waiting here? And I think he acted the hell out of it. No lines at all.
I mentioned at the top that I thought you were in Atlanta because you're always working. You've got like three projects coming out?
Yeah, right. Currently, I'm working on a show called The Big Door Prize with Chris O'Dowd in Atlanta. And I've been going back and forth for that. But I'm very excited about this show, Gaslit, that I'm a part of. It's a series that starts on April 24th on Starz. And it stars Julia Roberts and Sean Penn. I worked with both of them. And it's the tale of Martha Mitchell and the Watergate years and how she was suppressed by the people in her family and in her circle. It was a great experience. I get to play a senator and I get to grill her and also interact with Sean Penn. And it was a great experience. So that's coming out April 24th.
As I said, you've done so much work. You're a great character actor.
Thank you.
Which is, by the way, exactly what is longevity in Hollywood. If you're a character actor, you can work till your dying day.
Well, that's what I'd like to do. I mean, maybe a couple of days before I knock off.
But, you know, I'm sure a lot of people don't know your name, but everyone knows your face. When people walk up to you or people see you in a store or whatnot, do they realize you're somebody who's on television, or do they think that you were somebody they went to school with years ago?
Yeah, it's often like that, Peter. It's often like, have we met? Yeah. Are you a cousin of mine? It kind of depends on where you go too, because I think in LA people just assume if you're familiar that you must be an actor, and 90% of the time they'll be right. But when I go other places, people look at me like, have we met? Do I know you? Did we go to school together? Do you know Mitch? You know, things like that. When I used to do a lot of commercials in certain areas, I did a lot of commercials in Texas, grocery chain commercials. I was a spokesman for years, doing these wonderful improvised commercials where I would just interact with people and they would video it. And in Texas and in Florida and also in St. Louis. And when I went to those places, people were seeing me all the time on their televisions. So I did stick out. I could tell that people were recognizing me. And I felt like in small, very, very small pockets of the United States, I was intensely famous. And then all I'd have to do is, you know, go on the freeway for 5 or 10 minutes and I'd be completely anonymous again.
With all that you've done in your career, is there anything that hasn't come your way yet? Is there a holy grail of a role or a type of part that you'd like to have that you haven't done yet?
Oh, sure. I mean, you're always looking for something that has a lot of richness to it. I mean, I'm 62, and I look at my fellow actors that have really made it well, you know, that are really household names, people I've seen around for years, like Bryan Cranston and Bob Odenkirk and folks like that. And they've had an opportunity. They're really good actors, first of all. They're really dedicated. And they've had an opportunity to play drama and comedy, and every every emotion on that bandwidth. You know, if you think about Breaking Bad and what Walter White had to evoke, he went, you know, everywhere from being a very conservative guy to being a very evil guy, and just all those colors in between. And I think every actor yearns for a role like that, that which will allow him to really explore the human condition and all the various tones of it, you know?
Well, Jim, we look forward to everything you do, and I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. It's been a pleasure to have you on the program. Say hello to your mom for us.
Thank you, Peter. I will. Take care.
Veteran character actor Jim Meskimen. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0658, and you'll find links to Jim's site, plus links to his very popular YouTube channel and his equally popular TikTok channel. Also, check out his newsletter as well. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on the Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Available on Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and just about every other way you stream audio. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's everywhere you want to be, and some places you don't.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the author of the novel Painting the White House. Plus, Stuart Nolman is along with another edition of Book Banter. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way, and more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Hotels in Venice, Italy, announced that guests are being armed against the city's aggressive seagulls with an unusual form of protection: water guns. The AVA, the Hoteliers Association for the City of Venice, said guests are being given orange water guns to ward off the city's seagulls, which are known to aggressively go after food and anything else they see as edible. One recently snatched an ice cream from a tourist as she walked across St. Mark's Square. Said Paolo Lorenzoni, director of the historic Gritti Hotel, "The water guns really work. They're also colored orange, which the birds don't like. The birds are already learning to avoid anyone brandishing a water gun." Lorenzoni went on to say, "As soon as they see the pistols, they fly away. You don't even have to use them. You just need to keep them on the table." Yeah, this is all fun and games until the seagulls start using biological warfare, if you know what I mean. That squirrel you ran over on the highway could be a tasty treat. And if you live in Wyoming, there's an app that can help you make a legal claim of it. The new State of Wyoming app is helping to take roadkill off the pavement and onto the dinner tables of those who want them, all while making roads safer for the animals. In what could be the first app of its kind in the United States, the app's roadkill feature allows users to quickly claim accidentally killed animals such as deer, elk, moose, wild bison, or wild turkey after it is documented and reviewing collection rules for personal consumption. Wyoming is one of 30 states which allows people to collect roadkill for food purposes. Besides allowing people to document and claim the roadkill, it also helps ensure users follow the rules, such as no collecting roadkill after dark, along highways, or construction areas, or in national parks. The app also allows Wyoming to collect data, as geotagging roadkill will help biologists and highway officials to decide where wildlife crossing signs will go. You know, I just did a Google search. If you Google roadkill cookbooks, you'd be surprised at the number of titles that you'll turn up. Yeah. The day after Hurricane Ida hit Slidell, Louisiana last August, the local Popeye's chicken restaurant had a new guest. Employees named him Rocco. Said General Manager Muhassin Shepherd, "He'll go around to the front door, look around. He'll go around to the window, the drive-through window, and just look. We've been actually increasing sales and business. So, you know, meeting a lot of new friends just to come in and see Rocco." Rocco, by the way, is a rooster. He even has a coop the employees built for him, and drive-through patrons love seeing him there. Said one customer, "It's a little funny. We wonder if he's going to disappear one day." Well, you know if he does, everyone will suspect foul play. You know, they call someone a bird brain for a reason. I mean, a rooster hanging around a chicken restaurant isn't exactly the brightest move. That would be like me offering a linen cleaning service outside of a Klan rally. And we have time for one more story in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Harvey Weinstein is in more legal trouble again, but this time the disgraced movie mogul behind bars isn't in trouble for his sexual proclivities, but rather his sweet tooth. The former Hollywood film producer and currently imprisoned sex predator was recently busted for trying to smuggle in milk duds in prison.
Where's my milk dud?
After a meeting with his lawyers, Weinstein was searched in a jail medical facility, which revealed a stash of the banned candy on November the 10th. In a statement, Weinstein stated the incident was an innocent misunderstanding. It will not happen again. I have been a model inmate following the rules and regulations, and I am sincerely sorry. Weinstein had told jail guards he brought the chocolate with him from New York when he was extradited last July. However, a body search after he arrived in Los Angeles yielded no milk duds, which led guards to believe Weinstein's lawyers smuggled in the sweet goods.
Did you take my milk duds?
Weinstein's lawyers also apologized in a statement saying it had not happened before and never happened since.
Those bite-sized nuggets of delicious chewy caramel, completely surrounded with a scrumptious chocolatey coating. Milk duds are nutritious, too. They're rich with milk. Milk duds are everyone's favorite, so be sure to have enough on hand.
Harvey, not anymore. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Journalist Hal Markovitz has written a novel called Painting the White House, which tells the story of an ordinary house painter who finds himself at the center of White House intrigue and misadventures. But Hal also knows about some of the interesting and weird stories that have taken place through history in the real White House. He joins us via Zoom from Philadelphia to share a few of those stories. Hi, Hal.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program. Before we get to some of the weird goings-on in the actual White House, tell us about your book, Painting the White House.
Painting the White House is a work of fiction. It's a novel, and it tells the story of an ordinary house painter who gets hired by the First Lady to come in and paint the White House. So he gets into the White House on day one, sets up his ladders, puts down his drop cloths, opens his cans of paint, and starts getting down to work. And within no time at all, he finds himself involved in all the screwy intrigues and nutty things that go on in the White House. And it's kind of the story around the painter and what he encounters in the White House. So it, like I said, it's a novel. But as I was researching the book, I wanted to make sure it was very accurate in the depiction of the White House. So I started reading everything I could find on the White House. And it didn't take me long to find out, hey, guess what? There are some actually nutty things that go on in the White House.
So what did you find? And before you answer that question, did you find that there was a greater number of stories in the early days of the White House, or do some of the wacky things that take place or odd things that take place in the White House actually bring us up to modern day?
It goes from A to Z, so to speak.
Wow.
The nutty stuff started even before the White House was built. You know, I'm going to take a minute to tell you a story. The White House was designed by an architect named James Hoban, who won a competition to design the White House. And we're going back to the 1790s. So Hoban wanted to make sure everything went right. He wanted this job to be done right. So he had a cottage built on the construction grounds, and he moved into the cottage where he could oversee the construction of the White House 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's the way he looked at the job. So several months goes by and the White House is under construction. And at one point, Hoban decides, well, I don't have to live here anymore. You know, I can just show up during the day and keep an eye on the work. So he moves out of the cottage and he leases the cottage to a carpenter named Donahue and his wife, Betsy. So the Donahues move into this cottage on the White House grounds. And it doesn't take long, but it comes out that Betsy Donahue is running a brothel out of the cottage. So the first official or unofficial use of the White House was not exactly what we envisioned. The Donahues were kicked out, by the way.
Okay. I was about to ask, what's the weirdest and wackiest story you've gleaned from your research on studying the White House? But a brothel is kind of hard to top.
Oh, but you can top it, believe me.
Oh, really? So what do you got?
Well, you know, there was a story in the news a few weeks ago about Donald Trump was tearing up top secret documents,
right,
and flushing them down the toilet. Well, Donald Trump isn't the only president who has had an unusual relationship with the White House toilet, if I can put it that way. Lyndon Johnson, you know, president during the 1960s, used to have a very kind of public attitude when it came to using the toilet. If he was in an Oval Office meeting with a bunch of aides and heads of state and whomever, and he kind of felt the urge, there was a restroom, there is a restroom right next to the Oval Office. Johnson would just get up from his desk, walk over, open the door, sit down, do his business, and continue conducting the meeting.
Yes, I had heard stories about that, and I'd actually heard stories from people who were in the room at the time.
So, you know, it just seemed to be going on and on, the screwy stuff that happens in the White House. Funny story I encountered, this goes back to the 1930s, when the Hoovers were in the White House, Herbert Hoover and his wife. And the Hoovers did not like to encounter the White House staff. And by them, I mean the housekeepers, the cooks, the butlers, whomever, the domestic staff in the White House. They looked on the White House as their home, and they didn't want to see a bunch of strangers running around the place. So the domestic staff was issued tiny little bells. And they were under orders that if they were in the hallway or wherever and they saw the president or the first lady, they were to run and hide behind the, you know, inside a closet, behind the stairs, whatever. And they were to ring their little bells to as a signal to the other members of the staff to also do that. So the Hoovers could not, you know, would not encounter members of the White House staff. So this went on during the Hoover presidency. Now, a kind of funny little postscript is in the 1990s, the Clintons move in and Hillary Clinton, the new first lady, is walking down the hall and she sees a housekeeper dart across the hallway and jump into a closet. So she goes up to the closet and she opens the door and says, "What are you doing?" And the housekeeper says to her, "Well, Mrs. Clinton, we're under orders to hide when we see a member of the president's family."
Wow.
Hillary said, "Well, you really don't have to do that." But that kind of little tradition ended up staying around the White House for, 50 or 60 years.
Amazing. Now, I understand one of the stories I do know, there was a president who was too fat for the White House bathtub. Wasn't that Taft?
Yeah, that was William Howard Taft. He weighed over 300 pounds, and they had to install a bathtub just for him. And a couple other funny stories about Taft is he was known to fall asleep at his desk in the Oval Office. And the word is you could hear him snore all over the White House. Taft also owned an automobile. He was the first president to actually own his own car. and Taft liked to drive his own car. And what happened was at night, he would take the car out of the garage. I guess they had a garage in those days. He would take the car out and he would drive it over to the tidal basin in Washington, where all the other car owners in Washington would meet, and they would have a race around the tidal basin. This is the president of the United States, and he's in a car race around the tidal basin in Washington every night. I imagine the Secret Service kind of didn't like that idea.
Exactly. One more I want to get to. This one I was not familiar with. Apparently there was a president that had his underwear stolen?
Yes, that happened during the War of 1812, and the president was James Madison. And as we know, the British invaded Washington, and they went through the city, and the city was evacuated. And of course, the White House was evacuated, and the president and Mrs. Madison were taken out of town for their safety. So the British saw, there was about 150 British sailors, and they made it into the White House, and they looked around the place. And as we know, they set the place on fire. But before they set the White House on fire, some of the British sailors found their way into the president's bedroom, found his underwear and stole it. I guess there wasn't much chance to do laundry on those trips back across, you know, the ocean in those days. You find some clean underwear, you take it.
In doing your research, because there are so many stories like this that are out there, and there are so many stories that have become urban legends, did you find that there were stories that we all believed or we've all heard over the time that were not true about the White House?
I'm sorry. Everything I read is a fact.
Oh, wow.
I consulted very scholarly works of history, and all this stuff really happened.
So did George H.W. Bush actually shower with his dog?
Yes, that was his dog, Millie. And if you go on to the internet, you look for pictures of the Bushes with their dog, Millie, you'll see some wonderful photos of George and Barbara Bush kind of strolling around the White House grounds, and Millie's running alongside them. And they're just terrific, lovely photos. But when I understand, according to the scholarly works I have consulted, George Bush would take a shower and Millie often jumped in there with him. And I guess the two of them had a kind of a together moment.
And before we let you go, which president actually enjoyed answering the White House phone?
That was Rutherford B. Hayes. And what happened was he was president when the first phone was installed in the White House. This goes back, of course, 100 or more years. And the funny thing about it is the phone number for the White House was one, number one. So Hayes, when the phone rang, would insist on answering it himself. So the funny thing here is if you owned a phone somewhere in Washington and you knew the phone number of the White House, and it wasn't that hard to figure out, you could get the president on the phone.
I guess back in those days, you didn't get too many wrong numbers.
No, I guess not. I wonder who number two was. I'm just wondering what vice president had a phone.
Maybe vice president. Yeah. Anyway, your book, which is a novel, is called Painting the White House. It's available out now. Hal, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
All right. Thank you very much. And if folks go to paintingthewhitehouse.com, they can read more about the book and find out a lot of funny stories about the White House that really happened.
Hal Markowitz, author of Painting the White House. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0658, and you'll find links to Hal's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Latitude 47 degrees 14 minutes north. Longitude 84 degrees 39 minutes west. Location Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And here he is once again, Stuart Nauman, with a story of Anne Bancroft's husband.
That's right, Peter. No, that's Frankenstein, okay? Yeah, that's right, Anne Bancroft's husband. You're absolutely right. Because on this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at the life and career and art of Mel Brooks, as told by the person who knows him best, Mel Brooks.
Ah, yes.
Well, you see, from an early age, Peter, young Brooklyn native Melvin Kaminsky had a goal, and that was to do crazy shtick that would make people laugh. Now, when young Melvin changed his name to Mel Brooks, that goal still remained with him. Only this time, there were more opportunities available to him. This included being a TV comedy writer, creator, producer, performer, recording artist, screenwriter, and above all, movie director. And for more than 70 years, Mel Brooks has created an impressive track record of crazy shtick that made millions of people laugh.
Well, let's go back a second, because you kind of glossed over it a little there. When he was a comedy writer, has there ever been a stronger comedy writing room than on your show of shows?
I really can't think. I mean, look, each, you know, sitcom or, you know, comedy show had its share of great writer's rooms, but this was the gold standard. I mean, look what he had besides Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
You had Neil Simon and his brother Danny. You had Larry Gelbart. And for Caesar's Hour, you had Woody Allen. He joined in on the room. Lucy Kalin. Mel Tolkien, who was one of the creative forces behind All in the Family. Yeah, I mean,
Don't forget Carl Reiner.
Oh, of course not Carl Reiner. In fact, Neil Simon was so inspired, he wrote a play about his years with your show of shows called Laughter on the 23rd Floor.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. So, oh, yeah.
And also, a movie that was done that was sort of a takeoff on that was My Favorite Year.
Yeah. Excellent movie.
Which was written by Dennis Palumbo, who is a great writer, friend of this show. I've read all of his novels. He's an amazing person.
Yeah, and great script that he wrote. I always still remember, the takeoff of Sid Caesar, Stan King Kaiser.
Yes, yeah.
And the White Wall Tires.
Yes, exactly.
Just one thing, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall back in 1950-51 in that room. I just would have loved to do it. Anyways.
Well, you know, flies don't live long, so you'd be long dead by now.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Except in that science fiction version. But let's see what Mel Brooks has accomplished. I mean, like I said, besides, you know, he was a writer for your shows and Caesar's Hour. He was the co-creator of the 60s sitcom Get Smart. Then there was those albums that involved the 2,000-year-old man that he did with Carl Reiner. And, of course, director of such classic movie comedies as The Producers, Blazing Saddles, and Young Frankenstein.
And don't forget the short-lived show When Things Were Rotten.
Oh, yeah, that's right, with Dick Gaudier as Robin Hood and Dick Van Patten as Friar Tuck. I remember that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But throughout his life, Mel Brooks also carved out quite a reputation as a storyteller par excellence, and his many appearances on Johnny Carson's The Tonight Show are vivid proof. I mean, next to Don Rickles, I mean, Brooke can make Carson laugh uproariously. He really could. And that strong storytelling ability has been applied to good use with the recent publication of his memoir called All About Me. Very modest man. But there are plenty of fascinating anecdotes for the Mel Brooks fan to enjoy as he delves into his showbiz life in a chronological project-by-project manner. Like, for example, there's a time in 1950 during a writer's room conference in a Chicago hotel for a two-week in-person engagement Sid Caesar did shortly after the first season of Your Show of Shows. Caesar demanded new material for a show. Brooks then asked him to open a window to clear some of the cigar and cigarette smoke that permeated the atmosphere and let in some fresh air. Caesar, being the gentle soul that he was, responded with his famous quick temper by opening the window and then proceeded to grab Brooks by his collar and belt and dangled him out the window, asking him, "Got an affair?"
Oh, by the way, you mentioned Sid Caesar's temper and his, for lack of a better term, crotchetiness, I guess you can say. I've done my share of celebrity interviews over the years. Sid Caesar was the one interview that I said, "Thank you very much, Sid," long before it was supposed to be over.
Well, I think you were better off reading his autobiography, Where Have I Been? So you probably would have gotten a lot more from that.
I don't know. I don't know about where he's been, but I know where I'd like to send him at the time I was talking to him on the air. But anyway.
And another one. This is interesting. When he was casting for the role of the Waco kid in Blazing Saddles, Brooks originally approached John Wayne and then Gig Young. Now, Wayne read the script, liked it very much, but turned down the role, saying that the movie was too dirty for him. Then the part went to Gig Young, who, you know, he had quite a pedigree. He was an Oscar-winning actor at that time. So he accepted the role, but after his first day of shooting, was rushed to the hospital because he suffered from a bad case of severe alcohol withdrawal. And then Gene Wilder was shortly cast in the role that he made his own.
Yes.
He certainly did. But what I found interesting about the book, besides Brooks' wealth of behind-the-scenes stories, is that he doesn't take a negative tone with anyone he has worked with or with any aspect of his career in TV and movies, whether it be his examinations of the forgettable final two movies he directed, Life Stinks and Dracula Dead and Loving It, or even the studio bosses who demanded changes or deletions of some of his most controversial scenes. This was greatly exemplified during the production of Blazing Saddles when the head of Warner Brothers demanded a whole laundry list of changes, which included deleting the campfire scene and when Mongo punched the horse. And after the meeting, he realized that he might end up with the shortest film in history if he abided by these changes. So in typical Mel Brooks fashion, this is how he reacted to these suggestions. This is what he wrote in the book. "I sat down after he left," that's the executive, "tore up the page of notes off the yellow legal pad, crumpled it up, and tossed it into the waste paper basket." Yeah. So, all in all About Me is an entertaining, rollicking memoir of a living comedy legend who broke the rules to make people laugh at things they were too shy to even talk about, let alone laugh at. And only someone as audacious as Mel Brooks can make a fulfilling career of pulling such crazy shtick and getting away with it.
Well, you know, you said that he doesn't have a negative word for anybody in the book.
Yeah.
He's pleasant to everyone he's worked with. Well, of course he is. He's been through hell. He worked with Sid Caesar.
And don't forget, he nearly met his early end thanks to Sid Caesar.
Exactly. After that, everything was a piece of cake.
You know what? When you think about it, you're absolutely right.
Everybody's a ray of sunshine after Sid.
Hey, look, at least he wasn't there when, it's in Sid Caesar's memoir, when he tore a sink right off the wall.
Oh, by the way, that's the thing, too. Sid Caesar was freakishly strong.
Yeah, he was. And then Brooks mentions that strong. In the book. Yeah, you know what? We ought to give, Mel Brooks a medal for enduring that. And don't forget, he wrote for Sid Caesar for about, almost a decade.
Yeah.
With two shows.
Which could contravene the Geneva Convention.
Yes. Or we may need a special negotiator from the International Court of Justice in The Hague.
By the way, Mel Brooks, even though he is a master of comedy, and I own his box set because I am one of the biggest Mel Brooks fans on the planet, but even though he's so well in comedy, he does so well in comedy, he can be serious, like producing The Elephant Man.
Yeah, that's right. That was the first movie he produced under Brooks Films.
Yep.
Great movie.
He's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. So this week's book is?
Called All About Me by Mel Brooks, or Melvin Kaminsky. It's published by Ballantine Books, and it's $39.99.
Oh, good. And what other books in this genre do you recommend besides the story of Mr. Anne Bancroft?
Or that Mr. the gentle soul known as Sid Caesar. But I do recommend Carl Reiner's 2003 memoir, My Anecdotal Life, which he promoted very well at the at that year's Just for Laughs Festival when he hosted a gala.
I remember, yes.
Yeah, and also, if you remember, Peter, during the 60s and 70s, there was sort of the golden era of movie tie-in paperbacks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the ones for Mel Brooks's many movies were, you know what, I read those before I even saw the movies. But they were so well put together, and mostly they were written by some of the people who wrote the original screenplays. And I do highly recommend, I'll tell you right now, the tie-ins for Young Frankenstein and Silent Movie, which were done by Ballantine Books, Blazing Saddles and History of the World Part 1, which were published by Warner Books. And in the History of the World Part 1 tie-in, there's even a bonus recording. Do you remember those flimsy gift records?
Yep.
Well, there's that one of those in the book from the song The Inquisition. And High Anxiety, which was published by Ace Books. So I do recommend those if you could find them anywhere in a secondhand bookstore or, you know, garage sale, get them. I wasn't a big fan of paperback tie-ins, but these were really good.
Excellent. So again, this week's book is?
All About Me by Mel Brooks, published by Ballantine Books, and it's $39.99.
And how can people find you?
Well, they won't find me in the town of Rockridge, that's for sure. But they could find me within the pages of the Montreal Times every week. Either you could check out the digital edition or the website at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
That's Igor to you.
Werewolf. Werewolf.
Werewolf. Werewolf.
Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. I do have a couple more Stuff File news stories to share with you. And of course, there is an idiot of the day. So let's get right to it, shall we? In these days of high gas prices, it doesn't pay to be a thief. When Mecosta County Sheriff's deputies in Michigan responded to an alarm going off at a rural home, they encountered a man fleeing the scene. After running his license plate in the computer, they found that the car had been stolen in Grand Rapids and immediately gave chase. The chase didn't last that long. The thief led deputies eastbound on M20 at a high rate of speed before slowly coming to a stop. It seems the man, identified as 41-year-old Jared Thielbar, ran out of gas. He is currently lodged at the Mecosta County Jail, facing charges of fleeing and eluding, breaking and entering, motor vehicle theft, possession of stolen property, and open intoxicants in a motor vehicle. It turns out that the gas was so expensive that Thielbar couldn't afford to gas up his newly stolen rig. That's why he broke into a house, setting off the alarm. He was in the process of stealing gas. How ironic. And there are many reasons not to drive drunk with your kid in the car. Here's another. 49-year-old Kristen Wiley, a teacher, narrowly avoided striking a police car as she drove on a Vero Beach street at around 2 a.m. The cop car, with its lights flashing, had pulled over to handle an unrelated incident. When deputies approached Wiley's car, they spotted her son, who was not wearing a seatbelt, in the back seat, curled up and crying. According to police reports, the cop noted that the wobbly Wiley's eyes were watery and red in color, and there was a strong odor of an alcoholic beverage emitting from her person and her breath. When asked if she had been drinking, Wiley said no. That's when Wiley's son replied to his mother's answer by saying, Mom, you can't lie to the police. You did drink. The boy subsequently told cops that his mother had been drinking at a party and that she had asked her to slow down while they were driving back to their Vero Beach residence. The child said he was very scared while Kristen was operating the vehicle. Wiley's recorded alcohol content was nearly 3 times the legal limit. She was arrested for DUI and child abuse. Not exactly the mother of the year material, but hey, she did raise him to know that lying isn't right. Give her points for that. Anyway, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the Idiot of the Day.
Police in St. Louis, Missouri arrested 27-year-old Alan Robinson at 3 a.m. He attempted a carjacking by walking up to a vehicle and pointing a gun at the front seat passenger. Police were nearby, very nearby. When Robinson discovered he was attempting to carjack a fully marked police car, he took off running. There were numerous police officers in the area investigating a shots fired call, and Robinson was quickly apprehended. I keep saying this, no matter what you do in life, to be successful, you have to pay attention. I mean, why? Oh, why? If you're planning to carjack someone with a gun, would you not pay attention enough to realize that you're pointing a gun at 2 uniformed police officers in a fully marked squad car? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0658. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0658. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, or you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including KDXRadio.com, TrueTalkRadio.com, streaming on Audible, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp Singapore, WLSL LPFM Dade City, Florida, CKUW-FM Winnipeg, CFMU Hamilton, CKLU Sudbury, and local 107.3 FM in St. John. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Any rebroadcast of this copywritten program in whole or in part without the express written consent of...
Oh, God, who the hell are we kidding? Who's going to steal this show? God, who writes this stuff? Holder, what a kidder.